Hello, you're very welcome to Irish Imperial Lives. I'm Amy Philpin Bowman.
And I'm Kate O'Malley.
And today we are venturing for the first time to Imperial Russia. At the time, a growing force in the world and one that comes to threaten the British Empire. We've got two Irish perspectives on this. The first is an exceptional man called Peter de Lacy. He's only 13 when he takes part in the Siege of Limerick. He travels to the continent as one of the Wild Geese, but he winds up making an extraordinary contribution to the armies of Peter the Great at the very moment when Peter the Great is trying to westernise, soaking up talent from right across Europe. He finds this guy, Peter de Lacy, and my God, does the bet pay off.
Absolutely, and our wonderful contributor, Angela Byrne, tells us details of the many battles he was involved in. It includes Muscats, AB, which I think you're happy about.
An amphibious
invasion of Stockholm as well.
I suppose in a way the elephant in the room is the fact that the whole theme of Russian military expansion and even some of the geography is all been thrown into sharp focus ever since the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022. But we can't blame Peter de Lacy for that. He has been dead for over 200 years. But more to the point, we're not here to cheerlead for the Russian Empire any more than we want to cheerlead for the British Empire. The whole point of this show is to say, whether you like them or not, all of these people are part of Irish history, and we need to be honest about the role that they played in the empires that helped to build the world we all live in. We also have a very different Russian viewpoint.
This is a fascinating story of the relationship between Princess Stashkova and two Irish sisters, the Wilmot sisters, Martha and Catherine.
She's a major figure in the coup that put Catherine the Great on the throne.
That's
she then
right.
falls out with Catherine the Great. So did these sisters form this incredibly strong relationship? At one point, Princess Ekaterina Romanovna, to give her her full title,
ooh,
but better known as Stashkova, she's challenged by her own daughter. Why are you carrying on with this young Irish woman? Who is she to you? I'm your daughter. And Princess Stashkova responds by writing her own daughter out of her will.
Yeah.
We're joined today by Dr. Angela Byrne, author of Anarchy and Authority, Irish Encounters with Romanov Russia. And we began with Peter de Lacy, who was just 13 years old when he entered military service during the Siege of Limerick, a year on from the Battle of the Boyne, where William of Orange had defeated the Catholic King James.
He starts his military career when he's just about a teenager at 13, and he's participating in the Siege of Limerick on the Jacobite side as an ensign. And then very soon after that, catastrophically, all these elite Catholic military folk find themselves unemployable in Ireland and they flee to the continent. So he goes to France along with the Irish regiments who were formed there immediately after the Treaty of Limerick. He goes along with an uncle. He joins the Irish regiments in France. But then by 1697, this diplomatic treaty called the Treaty of Ryswick means that a lot of these Irish soldiers who are living in Western Europe can't really find employment anymore because there's a period of peacetime. So they start moving further east in Europe.
Because we're more familiar with the Wild Geese, say, in France and Spain.
A small number of them started going to, say, Sweden, Austro-Hungary, and then a smaller number again went as far as Russia.
So he fights in Piedmont for the French. He works, I think, in the Austrian army for a while. At some point, I think he applies for the Hungarian forces and he can't get in for whatever reason.
And he makes his way eventually on to the Polish military. And from there, he's kind of headhunted into Russia because around the same time that we have this like watershed moment in Irish history where the Catholic elite have to flee to the continent, we also have the ascent of Peter the Great in Russia. And he's the westernizer. He's the one who declares in 1721, I am emperor of all the Russias. He's the one who makes it really an empire. And he's looking west. So he's actually travelling around Western Europe early in his reign, headhunting every professional you can imagine, from architects to jewellers, artists,
really?
Military men, administrators, translators, you name it. He's headhunting these people in Western Europe and bringing them to Russia, you know, with the promise of great salaries and lavish living.
Huge incentives.
Yeah, and if you're an ambitious person, professional, and you're being told, I'll give you carte blanche to implement my great westernisation plan.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of attractive. De Lacy's swept up in that. He's one of the Western European highly regarded. And I remember at this point, he's still only in his 20s. He's already gaining a reputation. And the Irish in general have a good reputation for like loyalty and bravery. They're kind of mercenaries. Like we have this attachment to the notion that they were always fighting for the Catholic forces. But there's a small minority of really ambitious types like Peter Lacy, who will kind of just go for the highest bidder. And the terms and conditions of employment for foreigners in the Russian Imperial Army were better than they were for local Russian.
Oh, that's,
Russian.
That's a no-brainer then.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So he's a careerist, right?
He is, yeah. Okay. And he ascends very, very quickly in the Russian military.
Can you give us a sense, I suppose, of where the Russian Empire is at this point and how quickly is it expanding?
Yeah, this is part of the reason why Peter de Lacy is so interesting, because he comes to Russia at this time where it is really becoming an empire. So he starts his career under Peter the Great, who's massively ambitious autocrat who believes that he has been sent from God to save Russia and make it great. Do these sound familiar, these words?
That
so
makes sense,
he
yeah.
comes in at a time where during the 304-year-long Romanov dynasty, ending in 1917, the empire expands on average by 55 square miles a day.
A day?
It ends up being just over 22 million square kilometres in extent. It goes from the Baltic Sea in the west to the North Pacific in the east. It goes from the White Sea in the Arctic to the Black Sea on the edge of the Mediterranean and the kind of Central Asian world. It is a vast territory filled with hundreds of different ethnicities, about 104, speaking 146 different languages. It is up there with the British Empire and the Mongol Empire is kind of the top three in terms of land mass and just ethnic and geographic range in terms of the history of empire globally. It is absolutely staggering.
Gosh, and that the, daily rate is phenomenal.
Peter de Lacy's in at the ground floor on this expansion. Uh-huh. You know, it's not necessarily a positive story,
but it's
global
history. It's the reality.
Yeah, and in our place as a global diaspora, we need to acknowledge our place in these slightly more uncomfortable stories
That
well.
We are woven through them, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
So we're in this period of extraordinary expansion. And the other thing that I think listeners need to be reminded of is that in this era, Sweden is a vast military power. Can we talk a little bit about the Russian struggle with Sweden and how that impacts places like Poland and the map of Eastern Europe in this period?
Yeah, Sweden kind of tick a lot of people off with their expansionism and their aggrandizement. So in around 1700, there's actually a coalition of Russia and some other states around the Baltic region. And that sets off one of the major conflicts of the early 18th century, which is the Great Northern War, which drags on for over 20 years. And this is where Peter de Lacy really kind of makes a name for himself. One of the outstanding moments for his career during that long conflict between Russia and Sweden, it's Peter de Lacy's actions at the Battle of Poltava in 1709. The more senior command said, look, we've got to pull back. And de Lacy ignored the direction to hold fire. And he said, we're going to approach to close quarters and then fire. And that was the decisive thing that won that battle for the Russians.
Mm. We have our own Irish musketeer. I'm very happy about that.
It was a massive boost for the Russian propaganda around that. More importantly, in the long durée of Russian history, this is when Russia really comes to the fore and becomes recognised by Western European powers as potentially a threat, but also somebody they have to start formalising diplomatic relations with. At one point, one of the Irish diplomats who's working there in the mid-18th century, George McCartney, who went on to be the first British ambassador to China, and he had this stellar career, but early in his career, he's in Russia, and he describes Russia as a great orb that has protruded itself into Europe.
Oh,
and that captures the entry of Russia into the European diplomatic sphere and political sphere.
If I'm not mistaken, as part of that campaign against Sweden, he also commands an amphibious assault, which brings him, I think, within about 12 miles of Stockholm. Can you tell us any more about that?
Yeah, that's where he ultimately surrounds the city of Stockholm, and it's considered very daring. And it's one of those episodes that really kind of captures de Lacy's image as, you know, a man of derring do and great courage
there
and
you go,
kind of audacity.
Anything with derring do in it, I'm all about it. Bring us the derring do. He surrounds Stockholm. I mean, Stockholm, as people who visited will know this, is a bunch of islands, essentially, in the bay. So is he attacking it sort of by sea, by land, boat?
Yeah,
how do they attack?
They've got a massive Russian flotilla gathered in the bay surrounding the archipelago. He's still quite young, but he's got so much military experience. He's got this determination. It shows throughout his career path that he wants to rise up the ranks and he's determined to kind of show his mettle
yeah.
and push the boundaries.
I'm reminded so strongly of John Barry in our first season, the Wexford man who helped found the American Navy, but he also set to sail from, I think, the age of 9 or 10. And just that 10,000 hours thing, if you've done the time, you've learned an awful lot. And now, even at a young age, you're ready to take command and lead people into battle.
There's two or three more kind of key moments, I guess, that I would focus on during Peter de Lacy's career in the later mad rulers under whom he worked. And I can say a wee bit more about those in a minute if you'd like. But one thing I picked out was his role in the War of the Polish Succession, which is in the 1730s. And like, this has catastrophic outcomes for Poland. It puts a Russian favoured ruler on the throne. The ruler that they put on the throne, Augustus, gives up Poland's claim to vast regions, which are now part of Latvia. It was Livonia and Courland at the time. He hands that over to get his place on the throne. He was quite an impotent ruler and he wasn't really interested in politics, or really was more interested in a life of pleasure and indulging in his interest in the arts and so on.
Great empires tend to like the kinds of leaders who aren't very effective in their neighbouring states and who want a life of pleasure because they're very easily bought.
Very convenient. Yeah.
Something very similar happens during the British expansion in India.
But Peter de Lacy's role in all this is that in 1733, he accompanies General Munich, who's one of the three most senior military leaders in the Russian Empire, with 30,000 Russian troops, and they march on Warsaw. And this is to firmly establish Augustus on the throne.
And is that whole five-polar succession, again, that's about getting the Swedes out of that area to some extent? Or?
Yeah, and enhancing not just territorial expansion, but sphere of influence further into culturally, linguistically Slavic territories, extending the reach into neighbouring territories.
The other combat that he's heavily involved in, and this has some real resonances today, is a war with Turkey, which takes in the Crimea, takes in Azov, places that we've become very familiar with since the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Can you talk a little bit about that campaign?
Yeah. The Russians and the Turks were basically perpetually at war with each other from the 16th to the early 20th centuries. If you want to Google Russo-Turkish War, you'll kind of have to know which one you want to pick.
And of course, the Turks have a massive, I mean, it's the Ottoman Empire, but it's a huge empire
at
this time.
Think about two empires butting heads in the kind of loosely around like the Caucasus, the area around the Black Sea. And what's happening is the Russian Empire, we've spoken already about its expansion westward into places like Poland, but it's expanded to the south as well, into the Caucasus, into the Crimea, along the Black Sea. So in one of the many Russo-Turkish wars, but the one that Peter de Lacy had a role in, is later in the 1730s. He kind of goes straight from the Polish succession to the Russo-Turkish War of 1735-9. He's sent to take the Turkish bastion at Azov, and with an army of 28,000 Russians, he took it in 12 days. He then embarks on a scorched earth campaign. I mean, I just think this is horrific. He left Ireland in the 1690s, 100 years before the Irish people had experienced scorched earth campaigns by the Elizabethan forces. And here he is doing the same thing on behalf of the Russian Empire. It's just so striking to me that he had been from a Jacobite background and this is what he ends up doing. Anyway, he ends up storming this fortress at a place called Perikop, which had been considered impenetrable, but he takes it. And this is key because it's the gateway to the rest of the Crimean Peninsula. So he leads 40,000 Cossacks into that territory and they ravage the place.
40,000.
The numbers are staggering in all these battles.
There is another change of emperor. He's not involved in that, but he does end up, at least some historians have argued, saving St. Petersburg.
Yeah, so Empress Anna comes along. She's Peter the Great's niece. She promotes her lover, who's this extremely handsome German called Ernst Biron, and she's totally in love with him. All she can see is Biron, and she loses sight of running the empire and allows three Germans to run the court, run all the military affairs, run diplomacy. And those three Germans are Biron, her lover, Ostermann, and General Munich, who I mentioned Peter de Lacy fought under. She liked really kind of old-fashioned court entertainments. The court was a place of debauchery, rambunctiousness, a place where people were made mockery of, you know, just for fun, like nobles could be ridiculed for fun. Horrid pastimes, something that was called dwarf tossing. Oh, they had all the jesters who were frequently people with various kind of physical disabilities or people who were different in some way. She used to organise hair pulling fights between old crones and all sorts of mad stuff. But this is to give you a sense of what her court was like. It was absolute chaos. So people are not very happy. On her death, there's a succession crisis. The infant Tsar, he's 6 weeks old or something when he comes to the throne, Ivan VI, and his life is really tragic and sad as well. He becomes the Russian man in the Iron Mask because there's a coup. He's arrested, insofar as you can arrest an infant in a cradle, and he spends his entire life in prison. But this is how clever Peter de Lacy is. The night of the coup, the guards come in. He's asked, "What party are you with? Anna, who's the regent, who's watching over the infant Tsar, or Elizabeth, who's trying to take the throne?" And de Lacy's answer to the question is, "I'm of the party of the ruling empress."
Oh, very good. Thinking on his feet.
He well has done. Been around this man. He knows. Yeah. I'm a party of the ruling empress. Lovely.
So there's a massive amount of unrest in St. Petersburg, as you already hinted. And he's put in charge of getting those troops under control, restoring order to the city. This is hinting to us the extent to which he's a respected military leader.
He's not taking sides, but whichever side takes over, he doesn't want a bloodbath. He wants to keep order so that the empire can keep growing and he can keep his place in it, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's another example where we can see his new...
He does end up with a nice big castle, doesn't he?
He does. What's
Latvia today, but Livonia at the time.
He doesn't quite get put out to pasture, but he gets this nice kind of governorship role in the Baltics. Okay. He's governor of Riga for a while. It's Lutheran. His family gets special permission to be able to practice Catholicism.
And he's a practicing Catholic all the way through.
He is.
Is he, Angela?
Yeah.
Okay, fascinating.
He is. They end up with vast estates, along with estates in the Russian Empire come in serfed people. So again, to acknowledge that the family... Yeah. held and served people on their lands.
And what was the size of his family and who did he marry?
He married Livonian countess called Martha Filippina Fuchin, and she was a widow, but they did go on to have five daughters. And actually something I talk about in the book is how they strategically intermarried into other, not just Irish emigre military families, but other noble families in the western reaches of the Russian Empire. It's all very strategic.
Yes.
So he's his own little empire builder in a way. So we're going to shift focus and jump forward to talk about the Wilmot sisters.
Yes.
Can you just situate this for us? Who are they and how do they end up in Russia?
Yeah, with pleasure. They're my darlings. I've been studying them since 2003 and I don't think I'll ever stop. So they were born in the 1770s. They came from Cork. Their dad had come from England. He was attached to the British Army and then he became something called port surveyor at Cork. So they grew up in Glanmire. They're not noble. They've noble connections in Britain, but they've a lovely genteel upbringing. So Martha and Catherine grew up as among the nine children of Captain Wilmot and his wife Martha, who was of the Moors of Cork. And they, through family connections, become introduced in the 1770s to a Russian princess called Princess Dashkova. And Dashkova was one of the most significant Enlightenment figures. Not just in Russia, but in Europe and North America. She corresponded with, you name any great Enlightenment figure.
Voltaire.
She corresponded with him, with Benjamin Franklin. You name them.
A prolific letter writer, by the sense of it.
Yeah, and she published. She headed up the first Russian dictionary. She was head of the Russian Academy of Sciences. She was the first woman to be elected an honorary member of our own Royal Irish Academy. Okay. A couple of books that she donated to the Academy are still on the shelves in there today. You can go look at her handwriting if you like. And she assisted Catherine the Great with her coup.
Okay.
And she's kind of infamous for this.
So when they meet her, she's already been involved in that coup, Catherine the Great to power. And just give us the sense of the timeline here later than we were discussing.
Yeah, this coup is in the 1760s. She visits Ireland in about 1779, 1780. She spends a year here for the sake of her son's education. And she becomes totally enchanted with these lovely people. They do seem to have been lovely people. And eventually Martha and Catherine accept an open invitation Dashkova extended for any member of the Wilmot family to visit her in Russia at any time. And because when Martha and Catherine go to Russia, they are the guests of Dashkova, they live with her, they spend every day with her. They are hearing her old war stories about life at Catherine's court, about all the big noble names of the mid-18th century in Russia. And they're kind of doing oral history because they write all this down in their diaries and their letters. So thousands of pages of amazing first-hand records from Dashkova of her memories of life in its heyday. Now, she ends up being kind of cast out from the court. She becomes quite critical of Catherine during her reign and they have a falling out. She ends up being exiled for a while and then she kind of slowly makes her way back into the fold after Catherine's reign has ended. But she never fully reintegrates. So she's this elderly woman living in rural retirement who's become isolated from her old circle of friends and family. I have a lot of admiration for Dashkova and a lot of stuff that she did, aside from the fact, you know, she is a landholding owner of enslaved people and all the rest of it. But for a woman of her age, she's extraordinary, right? Uh-huh. And I think Martha gets kind of swept up in a Dashkova fever.
She's a little infatuated.
But she also comes to realise quite quickly, this person has developed a massive dependency on me. And she's writing in some of her letters and diaries, I can't leave her. I can't go.
It'll break her heart.
She needs me. So she keeps missing opportunities to leave because she doesn't have the courage to hurt Dashkova's feelings. It's very involved.
The sources here, Angela, it's diaries. So you're looking at personal diaries and letters. So,
as a historian, women's personal writings are one of the sources I've worked most with because you get that inner view. Mm-hmm. Uncensored, unedited.
It becomes an incredibly strong relationship, incredibly deep relationship. I mean, I think at one point Dashkova's own daughter sort of confronts her about how strong this relationship has become. Dashkova kind of basically chooses Martha over her own daughter.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot going on here.
There is.
Is this an entirely platonic relationship? It just seems so intense. You find yourself wondering if there's a sexual or romantic element there somewhere.
I've had that question a lot because I've spoken about them a lot. But actually, it's more that Martha has given herself the security of having a Russian mother. And she did call Dashkova my Russian mother.
She was getting lots of gifts as well, Angela.
Yeah, she
now,
was.
I'm not presuming that's what drove it.
Yeah.
But substantial.
Yeah. Catherine at one point comments on the amount of gifts and the monetary value.
Mm. Yeah, there's a wonderful quote actually in your work that lists some of the gifts.
This is the amount and the listing of the gifts that Dashka gave. There were gifts of money, diamonds and jewellery, shawls and sables, books, watercolours and prints, miniatures representing Russian and other European royals, a fan and a pink snuff box that once belonged to Catherine II, an opium pipe, schnapps cup and watch formerly owned by Peter I, an opal, once belonging to Christina of Sweden, and portraits of both sisters made by a Russian artist in which Catherine was depicted cloaked in furs. That's probably only the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, there was cash as well.
I'm thinking of the Antiques Roadshow episode here.
Well,
this
I'm
particular
still kind of
box in the attic
to find one of these things in a charity shop someday.
But I mean, that is significant.
I mean, if you think of that modern concept of like love languages, that gift giving for some people is a way of expressing or receiving, it's very, very strongly there.
But Catherine is sent over after 2 years to bring Martha home because the parents are like, you've been there 2 years, that's long enough. So Catherine is sent over with her servant girl, Eleanor Kavanagh, who I can say a wee bit more about if you'd like. But Catherine, after 2 years, there's a short window of peace in the Baltic and she and Eleanor return to Ireland. But Martha, again, can't bring herself
to go. So the sister goes and doesn't succeed in bringing her back.
Martha stays behind. And she ends up not going until winter 1808. And it's literally a crisis. The English are fleeing because now the way the alliances have gone in the Napoleonic Wars, Russia and England are now enemies.
Yeah.
So the English are fleeing Moscow and St. Petersburg. There's this Irish captain, Hamilton. We don't know much about him except that he was from Ulster. And he's constantly coming to Dashkova's palace with these scare stories, frightens the life out of Martha. She kind of really hastily gets her stuff together and goes. And they say this awful goodbye where they can't really say goodbye to each other. And she flees to St. Petersburg and then gets held up for weeks.
Wow.
And is ridden with guilt. She's writing every day about how terrible she feels. She's getting notes from the princess who's saying, you know, what's happening? Come back. You're safe here. And she eventually sails home but gets shipwrecked in the Baltic.
How long is she shipwrecked for? Sorry, I need to know that.
I think it was about a week on this island. And she wrote about how kind the islanders were and they took such good care of her and the other wrecked people.
Okay.
And then eventually makes her way back to the safety of England.
You make the point that, in fact, by far the most valuable gift she gave these sisters was the right to her memoirs and to edit her memoirs.
And the fact that it was the suggestion of Martha in the first place, which has me a little suspicious, Angela, I have to be honest as to her motives, but go on.
Yeah, so Martha writes in her diary that the princess, as a favour to me, is writing her history and has given me the permission to publish it. Now, Dashkova did ask Martha to wait until after her death. Martha ended up having to wait 30 years after Dashkova's death, because the Vorontsov family, Dashkova's brothers, objected so vehemently to the publication of this memoir. Martha and Dashkova sit down most days and Dashkova just writes pages. They're in the British Library now. Dashkova's lovely, big, loopy, confident writing, and she would pass them to Martha and Martha would transcribe them. And then you can see where they've kind of gone back and maybe Dashkova said, oh, put that in there or move this to here or change that word. So you can see the whole process. But the most important thing is that Martha translates it to English and publishes it in 1840. Mariah Edgeworth wrote to Martha when she read them when they were published.
Author of Castle Rackrent.
Yeah, one of our most famous female novelists. She wrote to congratulate Martha Wilmot on the publication, but she wrote separately to another friend to say, you know, I don't know how Martha Wilmot could have gone to all these parties where the princess Orloffs who killed Peter the Third were there, and you know, how could they bear to socialise with these Tsar killers and assassins? It's really interesting to see.
Is there a little jealousy there that she got she got the goods?
Yeah.
There's one other thread of the story we have to pull at because it's fascinating, which is that, as you've alluded to, Catherine comes to rescue her sister, doesn't succeed, but she brings with her her maid Eleanor Kavanagh, and her letters back to Ireland, Eleanor Kavanagh's, are published. And initially they're published by a rather snooty British magazine. I have the quote here somewhere. They expressed the native unsophisticated feelings of an uneducated Irish girl and present an amusing instance of the impression produced by novelty upon such a mind.
I have the printout here from the Universal magazine that published these and incidentally accidentally made her the first Irish woman to publish first-hand observations on Russia. This is a servant in 1813. I think this is amazing.
It's an upstairs-downstairs take.
Or a Downton Abbey take for anyone under 30.
Oh, Abby, is that a take at my age?
No.
Careful now.
The letters from Eleanor are fascinating because as a servant or lady's maid, she's not emigrating in her own right. She's accompanying her mistress on this adventure. Mm. And her letters are so full of colour, humour, sass, attitude. She writes down, you know, the kind of back chat she's giving to the Russian servants. She doesn't like the way they dress. She at one point complains one of them offered her some bread, but he said it in Russian. And she says, oh, you know, the poor creator didn't know how to say it properly. You know?
Fab.
I could read a couple of words just to give people
a
sense.
Yeah.
I'm going to read from a letter she wrote to her father in October 1805. She says, it's best, my dear father, to begin by mentioning that I'm in Russia. Indeed, where we are now, in a fine country palace, is many 100 miles from the first big town that we came to, that they call St. Petersburg. We are in a very pleasant carriage, the time of coming from Petersburg, and travelled 8 days and 8 nights too. My mistress bought me blankets and a pillow, the same as herself. I'll engage, I slept through the night fair enough, and stretched at my full length, because it was queerly made for travelling through the night as well as the day. Well, sure enough, we drove right into Moscow, and 'twas the handsomest palace I ever saw. An army, Lord knows, might live unknown in the house. This was Princess Dashkova's. I'll engage, I'll never forget it.
Wow.
Huge thanks to our guest today, Dr. Angela Byrne, who is the author of Anarchy and Authority, Irish Encounters with Romanov Russia. And I want to say a particular thank you also to David Maloney, one of our listeners, who got in touch suggesting that we do an episode on Peter de Lacy. And if you enjoyed it as much as me, I hope you'll join me in thanking David for that.
Also thanks to all of those who are responsible for helping us get the series on the air, to Jack Murphy, Elizabeth Larrigy, Nigel Wheatley, and also our theme music is from composer Bill Whelan's Belfast Linen and Lace.
And of course, you can listen back to all our episodes on the RTE website or wherever you podcast if you just search Irish Imperial Lives.